from NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Our guest in this portion of the show, a guy who loves words. Paul McFedries is a nut about words in their infancy. Words are combinations of words that offer us a fresh linguistic observation about our world. He's a neologophile, perhaps more accurately, a neologophiliac. He says language is not a solid mountain to be admired from afar, but rather as an active volcano to be studied up close. Two examples, Seabiscuit Candidate and SPIM. A Seabiscuit Candidate is a political candidate who comes from behind to win the race. And SPIM, S-P-I-M, that's junk mail, spam, received via instant messenger. Paul McFedries is the creator and president of Logophilia Limited and the author of Word Spy, The Word Lover's Guide to Modern Culture. He's also the author of many titles in the Complete Idiot's Guide series, including The Complete Idiot's Guide to a Smart Vocabulary. His book Word Spy is published by Broadway Books. You might also like to look up Word Spy on the web. The site's address is www.wordspy.com. Listeners, you can join the discussion with a telephone call. I look forward to your questions and comments. Here are the numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Paul McFedries, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
You're welcome, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
When did you discover your love for words, and in particular for new words?
I've always loved words ever since I was little, and it really morphed into a love of new words after I started a mailing list on the internet back in 1995. It was really just an average word of the day mailing list, just words I'd come across in my reading or my writing. But what I found that resonated with me the most and with my subscribers were new words, words that weren't in the dictionary yet that were being used out there, maybe in newspapers or magazines or on the radio, and I started focusing on those in 1996, and that's what Word Spy has been about ever since.
Yeah. Now, what is a new word? How do you define new word?
My own definition is a word that's not yet in any general mainstream dictionary, but that does have some track record in the language, as I say, whether it's in newspapers or books or magazines. My minimum is 3 unique citation. So that way, I figure it's not just a word that someone just made up on the spot that will be here today and gone tomorrow, but it is out there somewhere in the culture that some people have heard it on the radio or seen it in the magazines or books or newspapers, and so it has some chance of making it into the broader culture and maybe sticking around in the language for a while.
Mm. Is it difficult to be a word detective?
No, it's not. Not difficult in the sense that it's a heck of a lot of fun, and whenever I'm working on a new word, I'm having the time of my life because I really love doing it because it tells us some things about not only language but the culture itself. In terms of finding new words, you know, that can be a little harder. I mean, everyone makes up new words all the time, so there's lots of new words out there, but finding these ones that are in that in-between stage where they're not quite permanent part of the language yet, but you know, have been around for a little while. Those are a little harder to find, and those are the ones I'm looking for. And I find one, you know, one or two each day. Anyways, it's
what's
out there.
Yeah. Now, once you hear something or see something, where do you go from there?
Then I start researching, and I go to some of the large databases of articles like LexisNexis and Factiva, which used to be Dow Jones, and of course I'll Google it, and I'll go to some online sites that, like Wired, if it's a technology word, or news groups. I've got maybe anywhere from 10 to 20 sites I can go to really try and pin down, A, who's using the word, B, how long have they been using it, and if I'm really lucky, who used it originally. That's rare to find out who first started using a word, because normally it's someone just in a conversation or maybe a chat group or something like that. There's no written record of when the word was first used, so that's pretty rare find. But mostly I'm just happy if I can find the first citation, the earliest one, whether it's in a newspaper or online.
Do you get suggestions or tips from people who visit your website?
Oh, sure, yeah. There is a feedback feature on the site, and I get lots of suggestions that way. Most of them are either words that people have made up themselves, and they just want to get it on the site to let other people know, which is fine, too. I like all new words, so I don't mind that. Some of them are words that are already on the site. A lot of them are words that aren't new at all. If, you know, you look it up in, say, the Oxford English Dictionary, and you might find that, you know, a term is 100 years old or something. It's the language is huge. You're talking about hundreds of thousands of words already in the language. So it's, you know, in one sense, it's kind of hard to make up a new word because, you know, someone's probably thought of it before. But so most of the words that I do research are words I've just seen myself either through my own reading, or I have a few tricks I use with some of the databases to look for new words as well. Mm.
Well, share a couple of your recent finds with us.
Well, we've had the one yesterday was yestersol, which is the a term that some of your readers, your listeners might be familiar with from the Mars missions. Yestersol means one Mars day ago, and the NASA people were using that. They couldn't, because a Mars day is different than an Earth day. They're about 8 hours different, so they couldn't say yesterday wasn't accurate in terms of a Mars day. So they call a Mars day a sol. It's for sun, and so the previous Mars day was called yestersol, and you're seeing, so yeah, that's been used since late 2003, and you're seeing it showing up from time to time. That was a fun one. One recent one that I really enjoyed was spinach cinema, and that refers to movies that are not particularly exciting or interesting, but one feels one must see them because they're educational or uplifting in some other way. So it's like spinach. It's maybe not necessarily tasty, but it's good for you, so you feel like you have to eat it.
Yeah. Some people would say public radio is spinach radio.
Yeah, maybe, yes.
And, you know, I like that yestersol word a lot, and I can imagine people spinning that into something like yestersol time.
Uh-huh. You see people singing the Beatles song Yesterday with exchanging yesterday for yestersol. And, yeah, it's... you know, it's a technical word that's used by the engineers at NASA, but it's an evocative word, and it's an interesting word, and so people, you're starting to see people picking it up and using it in different contexts, and that's, to me, that's when a word becomes truly interesting, when it breaks out of its niche, its original place that it was born, and it gets used in the wider culture in some different way. That's, to me, that's when it's particularly interesting, because now people are taking that word and being creative with it, and using it in new ways, and I really enjoy when I see a word that would do that.
Mm. I went to your website this morning, and I found a couple of words right off the top that were great. One of them, Washington Reed.
Yes.
That is just very recently coined, apparently, huh?
Yeah, that was, well, it's recently in the news. That's actually been around originally about 20 years ago, I think, the first citation was, although... that was in 1983, I think, and then it wasn't used very much. 1985 was the first one, I now remember it, but it wasn't used very much for about 10 years, and then people started using it a little more. But, of course, it's been in the news a lot lately because some of the testimony of Richard Armitage at the hearings onto the September 11th, 2001 terrorist attacks, he was talking about
Clark's
book,
Red. Yeah.
And it just asked him. Someone asked him if he'd read it, and he said, "No, I gave it the Washington Reed," meaning that he looked in the index to see if his name was in there, and then read the parts that pertained to him only. So that's the way people in Washington allegedly read their books.
Yeah, I guess it's akin to Googling yourself.
That's right, ego surfing. They also call it.
Yeah, the other term I want, or the other word I wanted you to talk about before we go and talk with a listener is offshoreable. That's very useful.
Oh, yeah, especially these days. That's one of the features you see with words is that, you know, it's not just people making up words because they can make them up. It's these words have resonance within the culture. So offshoreable means capable of being moved to another country, especially to reduce costs. So it's really deals with jobs and job functions being moved to cheaper locations. And it's going to be a huge election issue this year. It already is. And, you know, so now you're getting these terms. So this is an adjective that's come out. The idea of something, you know, just the offshore as a verb, or offshoring, or outsourcing. These are all older words, but now, you know, the culture is saying, well, here's this important concept. Now we need an adjective rather than something long-winded that, you know, a 5 or 10 word thing that we have to say. Let's just have this nice simple adjective called offshoreable. And once you know what it means, the word is quite simple to understand, and also tells you a lot about the underlying phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine is Paul McFedries. He is the author of Word Spy, The Word Lover's Guide to Modern Culture. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join the conversation this afternoon with a phone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I got two words and a phrase to bring up. One that really annoyed me for a long time was parse. I couldn't figure out what anybody meant by that, except maybe be careful about what they're saying. Do you know anything about that one?
Well, parse is that's a computer term, and you know, there's such a thing as a parser in computers. And what that means is it takes a statement, a computer statement, and it breaks it down word by word. And then looks at the meaning based on these individual components, and then translates that into language that the computer can understand. So, you know, parsing, which is, you know, it's also a grammatical term too, because a grammaticist will say that if you parse a sentence, you break it down into individual components like noun, subject, predicate, that kind of thing. So, and that's been around. That sense has been around for hundreds of years. So what we're seeing now, and this often happens in language, is that words get a broader meaning in the sense that rather than a specific meaning in terms of computers or in terms of grammar, the broader meaning is, let me parse what you just said, meaning taking the individual components of your sentence or paragraph and looking at them individually to see, you know, what those might mean, and therefore getting the larger sense of what you're saying by looking at the individual pieces.
Hmm. Well, the phrase I was going to mention I heard on Day by Day, an NPR program. They were saying that juror number 4 was becoming a useful phrase.
Yeah.
And my current annoying word without definition is props. I don't know where that came from. I get the meaning now. Apparently they mean... you know, some sort of praise, but where did that? Where the heck did that come from?
That's short for proper respect. So, if you give someone their props, you're giving them their proper respect.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's really just a short form of that phrase. So it does mean praise, but it also means, you know, the slightly broader idea of respecting someone for who they are and what they do. And so, props is just, and that, again, that happens a lot. A lot of slang is just a shorter way of saying some longer thing. So you don't want to, you know, saying proper respects is a fairly formal thing to say, but props, that's nice hip-hoppy and street slangy, and so that's why you'd see something like that being shortened.
Oh, that is hip-hop, then.
Yes, that's where it originated, yeah.
All right, thanks.
Okay, thanks for the call this afternoon. Other questions are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, since we've mentioned slang here, why don't you talk with us a little bit about slang, thoughts on slang. Maybe you'd talk with us about what's in-grouping and out-grouping.
Yeah, it's slang is one of those... one of the basic ideas behind slang is to separate whatever the group is using the slang from everyone else. It's if you speak the lingo, then that's an identifying marker for your group. So if you can use the language in the right way, and use the right word, then you're part of that group. So that's called what linguists call in-grouping. The opposite is an outsider who tries to use the group slang but doesn't use it in the right way or at the right time, and then that's out-grouping, because then you're proving that you're not part of that in-group. And you see marketers do that all the time, where they'll try to use a slang term in some sort of context that's just wrong. So they're just they try to be cool by using the term, but they prove themselves to be decidedly uncool by using the slang term in the wrong way.
Yeah. I heard someone sometime back, and I thought this was pretty clever, sort of out-grouping herself. She said, "I'm skewing old here." And I thought that was, you know, meaning wrong demographic. I don't know what you're talking about. I like that.
I like that.
Yeah. Skewing old here. This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. Paul McFedries is our guest this afternoon. We're talking this afternoon about words and language. He is the author of Word Spy, The Word Lover's Guide to Modern Culture. You'll also find him on the web. Look up Word Spy on the web, www.wordspy.com. Questions? Comments? They are invited. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Our first caller this afternoon told us about feeling, you know, somewhat annoyed by some of these words that crop into the language, because, you know, it's like, well, what do you mean, you know? Mm-hmm. Do you get this complaint? Do people complain to you, you know, these words aren't, you're not showing the language props, proper respect?
Well, I think I do get that. Not very often. I think most people who come to the site are people who love language, and you know, to my view is I'm really a descriptivist. I just like to see what the language is doing, what people are doing with the language, and then describe that in some way. I never try to judge the language, because the language always changes. It always has changed. And you try to read Chaucer, for example, and you know, it's almost unreadable, not quite, but almost, because the language, English, has changed so much in those hundreds of years. And you know, even some of Shakespeare, and so you know, that's just a given, that language always changes and that there's always new words. I mean, every word was once a new word. So, and I'm probably, you know, every word someone has complained about at some point that we didn't need that, or whatever the complaint might be. So, but no, I just have fun with the language, and I just think it's wonderful that we have this inborn creativity in all of us, because everybody makes up new words at some time or another, even if it's just a slip of the tongue, but or even just more a definitive way of creating new language. Everyone can do it, because we all know how to speak the language. We've all had lots of experience with the language, and we've used it in different contexts. So it's just this universal democratic creativity that just blows me away every time, because I see it every day that you know, it's not just professional writers who are coming up with these new words. It's all sorts of people. It's just average Joes and Josephines like us who come up with the word, and maybe it gets in print somewhere, and then suddenly it's part of the language. It's really exciting and fun for me.
Let's talk with some more listeners. Next, we're going to go to a caller on line 4 in Farmer City. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering. You know, this is a fascinating topic, and I was wondering if you were influenced by George Orwell's book, 1984, when, you know, how they have the new speak in this mm-hmm. book.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that was, that's a wonderful example of changing the language to fit political means. And, you know, I try not to get political on the site, but sometimes you can't help it, because words sometimes do have an inherent political slant to them. One phrase that is on the site is homicide bomber, which is, the Bush administration started using that phrase after a number of suicide bombings in the Middle East. And, mm-hmm. you know, their idea was that this is It's murder in their view. So this was a better phrase because there are homicides going on here. It's not just the suicide of the person with the bomb. And there's an agenda underlying that, of course. And you have to be a little careful how you use a phrase like that. But then you also need to know that's out there and that that it is being used in a political context. So sometimes we need to know and understand how the powers that be and the elites are using certain terms, because if they're using them in slightly different ways with political or other shades to them, then if we're not aware of how they're being used, then all of a sudden they're different, and whatever is underlying that word or phrase, whether it's just a political philosophy or something more sinister, maybe then you can't appreciate it. So, in that sense, Orwell was right that words can define a political reality, and I think it's very important to be aware of words and how they're being used, and that's one of the ideas behind the site. Not so much political, but just cultural in general. That the words are a starting point for what's going on in the culture, what's new, and if you understand the language or how the language is changing, what new words are coming down the pipe, then you can understand a little bit more about the world as a whole. So that's, politics is a particular aspect of that, but I think it's very, very important.
Indeed. Right. All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. I guess what you're really after is logo literacy.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's, there are many different kinds of literacy, and, it's not just reading and writing anymore. It's parsing, if I can use that verb again, to looking at the words and looking at the cultural phenomena that underlie them. Why, when I see a new word, one of the first things I ask is, why do we have this new word? What's the cultural impetus behind it? Why are people using the word, and why did someone come up with the word, and what is it telling us about what's going on in the world, and why do we need this word? And, that's really what I do in the book. It's not just a list of words. I take particular aspects of the culture and use new words as starting points and saying, okay, what's going on in the world? What kind of things are happening? What phenomenon are going on? What are the statistics saying to back those things up? And it was just, it was fascinating to me to really look behind the words and see what was going on.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign on line one. Hi.
Hi. I have two words I'm curious about that I usually find on op-ed pages. The first is blog, B-L-O-G, and the other is bloviate.
Okay. A blog is, that's short for weblog, and this is a new phenomenon that's taking the Internet by storm. You saw it with the Howard Dean campaign, certainly. And the idea, it's really just it's a web page that consists of frequently updated chronological entries, usually on a particular topic. So you can think of it as a kind of a diary, but it's more than that. It's a list of links to interesting places, or it might be a person's just take on the news of the day, but it's just a chronological list of little blurbs, usually about something interesting, but most of the time not. But web log. It was used to be the idea originally was a log of interesting things,
and then
they just took web log was two words, then it became one word, and then it just became blog. It's not the most attractive word I've ever come across in my researches, but obviously that's a word I think that's here to stay, because certainly after what Howard Dean did with using bloggers, that's the name for people who create and write blogs, using them as a source of campaign funding and campaign advertising and just getting the word out, now blogs have really become mainstream, and it's really quite interesting what he's done with that. So it's one of those phenomena that's only a few years old. I think the first blogs were probably 1999, I think the first ones came in, so they haven't been around that long, and less than 4 years later they're taking over these parts of our political processes, which is interesting in itself. And the other word you
bloviate.
Said was
Bloviate. Good word.
Yeah. I think that one just means, you know, to speak, you know, really long-winded and grandiose and over-expansive way, using big words and taking 10 sentences to say something, in one. That so it's I'm not sure where the word came from, but it's that's the basic meaning, anyways. And I think if I continue, I'll just run the rest of the, the word myself.
Okay, does that get at our listeners' questions there?
Yes.
Okay.
I looked up bloviate on the internet, and I think it went back to the middle 1800s.
Really. Yeah, it's actually been around for a while. It's probably about 150 years old, I think.
Yeah.
So it's not new, although it's, you know, one of the interesting things with language is that words can come and go. So bloviate was pretty popular in the mid-19th century, and then kind of disappeared for a while, and now you're seeing it. For some reason, people on the internet have taken to this word. They've just taken a shine to it, and you know, so it's had this renaissance in the last 10 years or so. So bloviate is interesting in that sense, that it just suddenly came back into the language, and now it's popular again. So that happens sometimes. Nobody knows why.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Next, we're going to go to a listener on line 3. Caller on a cell phone. Hi.
Hello.
Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know you. There are people that have disabilities have frequently had to live with some kinds of barriers, architectural and such. And one of the barriers that they've had to deal with is the attitudes of people who have low expectations of them. And one of the words that's commonly used around the University of Illinois and some other places is attitudinal barriers. And the other day I was typing on a computer and happened to use that word, and it came up as an incorrect spelling. I was wondering if you were familiar with that word.
You're talking about the phrase as a whole or just attitudinal?
Attitudinal barriers.
I'm not familiar with it, but, you know, it sounds like a perfectly useful phrase to me. You know, of course, the computers, the dictionary that they use would be quite old, and so anything that's even remotely new wouldn't be reflected in their word list. So, you know, a lot of these new words, they get the little squiggly underline when you type them into Word or something like that. So, you know, as far as, attitudinal barriers sounds to me like the perfect way to describe what a lot of handicapped people have to put up with in order to get, you know, whether it's wheelchair access into some place or even just to be seen as regular people and not to be seen as victims or whatever. Those are all attitudes that get in the way of being treated with respect and being treated normally. So, sure, you can call them attitudinal barriers. I love it. I think that's a great phrase.
Well, I was wondering, is it possible that I've introduced you to a new one?
You certainly introduced one for me, for sure. I can tell you that. I'm writing that one down as we speak, and I'm going to check into it.
Excellent. Well, it's a phrase from Mr. Tim Nugent, who has a lot of work that he's done around the university. And I think that probably he's one of the first ones to coin that, I would guess. Because a lot of things with people with disabilities have evolved from the University of Illinois, and they're coming up now. They have a T-shirt that says resistance or freedom from architectural, attitudinal, and I forget what the other one is right now, but those different barriers for people with physical challenges.
Great.
Thank you. I hope I introduced you to a new word.
Thank you. I love it. Appreciate it.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign, line 2. Hi.
I think you're talking to me.
I am talking to you. Go ahead.
Okay. I was going back to the phrase about rather than suicide bomber or the comments, well, what was the word?
Homicide bomber, yeah.
What the, yeah, the suicide, what was it? Homicide. Mm-hmm. It was in the word.
Homicide bomber.
Say it again.
Homicide bomber. Yeah.
A homicide bomber. Yes. And when I first heard that, I thought it was great. That's a really meaningful word, considering what those people do. And but my political persuasions are such that when you say, well, it was introduced by the Republican administration, makes me say, I don't want to use that word, but it's a good word. I now wonder if you'd talk a little bit more about that phenomenon of how good words don't get used or do get used because of such things as that.
Well, yeah, it's, you know, as I say, lots of words do have political undertones. I mean, what...
Well, and, you know, religious, political, all sorts of things come into that sort of thing as to whether a person is of a particular political persuasion or religious persuasion or whether they are, you know, or agnostic or atheist. The fact that that the word is used by that particular group ends up sort of making it a bad word for a lot of other people.
Sure. I mean, some words have a definite emotional charge to them, and, you know, if you use them in the wrong context, then you can insult people, or you can, you know, or people can get the wrong idea about you, you know, because they may think that you have, you know, a certain agenda or certain beliefs or something that you don't may not have. You're just trying to use the word. So
yeah, that's sort of what I was thinking about.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's... sometimes it can work the other way, too. I mean, homicide bomber probably is still a pretty emotionally charged phrase to use. But you look at regime change, for as another example. That one actually started in the Clinton administration back in, I think, about 1999 or so. Right. But what we've been seeing, though, is that people have been using regime change outside of certainly in an Iraqi context or even a military context. They've been saying, you know, the baseball team, you know, the manager's no good, we need a regime change there, or, you know, we hate our CEO, we need a regime change. And so, that, you know, that's the idea I was talking about before, where words that have, or any word can have come up with a broader meaning and a broader number of senses to them. So they don't mean what they originally did, they mean something... you know, in a wider context in the culture. And so, you know, regime change would, you know, a few years ago would have had a pretty politically charged and militaristic connotation to it, but now it's almost become, well, we're so used to it now, but it's also become so broad in the language that, you know, those overtones are no longer there so much, and it's not tied to a particular political entity or to a particular military doctrine. It's just become part of the language and people are using it. So the opposite, you can get the opposite thing happening as well.
Okay, thank you, Lon.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. That reminds me of the word scofflaw, which was coined by a proponent of prohibition. He was concerned about the number of people who were flouting the 18th Amendment. And so he set up a contest with a reward, a prize, for the best word to describe those who were breaking the law. And we got scofflaw out of that. And today we don't use it in that sense, but we use it to describe someone who, you know, scoffs at the law.
Yeah, disregards the law. Luckily it wasn't law loose liquor lover, which I think was one of the entries. So.
Yeah, that was one too. Law loose liquor lover and boozlack.
Right,
and
hooch sniper.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's anytime you get the linguistic contest like that, you get lots of fun. Skycap was another word that came from a contest, and most of the time, the words that that win these contests don't get very far in the language. But those are two that I highlight in my book that did make it through and are full standing members of the language today.
Yeah. Well, today we talk a good deal about reality television, but there were some other contestants, so to speak, in the race for how to describe what reality TV is.
Oh yeah, there's you know, they've been trying to. There's lots of terms that are out there. Dramality was one that that was the guy who came up with Survivor. I think Mark Burnett. He insists on calling them dramalities because they're they combine drama and reality, but it's such an awkward word. I don't know. It's, you know, it is out there and people use it, but I don't think too many people really want to.
There was one that I thought might be appropriate, though. It was about it had the word humiliate within it. Humiliation TV or something like that. You don't recall.
I don't remember
so
that.
So many words.
Peeping Tom TV, is that?
Yeah, that was in there, too, Peeping Tom TV.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, on some of these shows, you know, it can be like Peeping Tom. It can be humiliating. I mean, if you're going to see someone manscaped, right? And maybe you should tell us what manscaping is.
Manscaping is the artful shaving and trimming of body hair.
Yeah. So.
And it comes, of course, from the Fab Five of Queer Eye for the Straight Guy. They use that term a lot.
Yeah.
And
take care of that monobrow.
Or the unibrow.
Yeah. Unibrow, yeah. Let's talk.
They've had some interesting, they have some fun with words on that show. It's been good for coming up with new terms and new interesting new things, for sure.
Let's talk with some more listeners. Next, we're going to go to a caller on line one, another listener on a cell phone. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I was wondering, it was about a year or 2 years ago, I heard on the radio that they were having a competition for a word to describe either handicapped or crippled or disability. Other than that, would have less connotation in a person's mind. But I think the prize was $100,000. I was wondering if you had heard of that and if anyone won.
I haven't heard of that contest, although these kinds of contests go on all the time, all over the place. It's amazing that. Although I think I would have heard about $100,000 prize. I would have gone into that myself. But I mean, certainly there are lots of words out there that are that put a more positive spin on having a handicap or like disability, or even just the old ones like physically challenged and mentally challenged, visually challenged, differently abled or disabled is another one, specially challenged. These have been around for a good 20 years or so. So maybe a lot of people complain that this kind of language is too politically correct. And so I don't know if they were trying to come up with something that didn't have that whiff to it or not. I'm not sure, but
I
wish I had heard about it. I would have entered myself.
Well, it still may be going on. I haven't heard of a winner, so you still have a chance.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. We talk with another listener, a caller on line two in Urbana. Hi.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
Yes. I want to put in my, I guess, useless objection to the use of Democrat Party as opposed to Democratic Party. Now, I know that Dennis Barron is on my side. I called in about that, too. This was, I think, the first person I remember hearing saying it was Bob Dole, but it had been in existence long before, I think. And as a person who remembers the old days of the civil rights struggle in the South, when it was okay to call a black a Negro, then the Southerners called a Negro a Nigra. And Democrat Party has the same infuriating quality to it as the word Nigra did in those days. It's because the Republicans don't want to admit that the Democratic Party might be actually Democratic.
It's actually funny. I think that it's probably used because it does get under people's skin, and so I think you're just reacting in the way they want you to. I think it's been around. That's been around for a long, long time. Either, you know, I think your specific use of going the actual name of the party, but the, you know, there's also the idea of Democrat being used, you know, as an adjective, so you would say something like it's being done in a Democrat way as opposed to a Democratic way. You know, that's been around probably, you know, since the early 19th century anyway, so it's not new, but, you know, I certainly can, you know, empathize with why you feel that way, because it does great, it just doesn't sound right at all. But I would just say that they're probably doing that on purpose to tease you.
But it has been adopted by Democrats.
Has it been?
And even the BBC has adopted it as what they think is the equivalent of American King's English. And I've heard local Democratic politicians talk about the Democrat Party. I think his name was Connor, who was running against Frerichs in the last local election, said Democrat Party. And I'm almost sure, although I hope I'm not sure, I hope I'm not right, that I heard Senator Edwards saying that. It just absolutely...
Well, it's probably similar to, President Bush says nuclear all the time. And,
well, nuclear, yeah, but that's a common illiteracy that's not politically motivated, I don't believe.
Well, you know, as it may be just in the heat of the battle, too. I mean, if Democrats are saying Democrat Party, then, you know, that doesn't sound politically motivated to me either. They're just, you know, saying something that's a little shorter, one less syllable, I guess, and when they're in the middle of a speech or in the middle of saying something. So, you know, more often than not, when people say something that doesn't sound right, it's because they're shortening, lopping off a syllable here and there, which we have a real tendency to do in the language. We want things to be... to go a little quicker, especially in these days when everything is hurry up. So, you know, I don't really understand why Democrats would do it. I can understand why Republicans why Democrats are doing it, the only thing I can say is that they're just trying to save a syllable here and there.
Well, do you think I should go on protesting?
Well, yeah, you should always. If it bugs you, then of course you should. I think, it may be, maybe just need to point it out to some people. It doesn't work for President Bush with nuclear, but it may work for Mr. Edwards if he's saying it or anyone else is saying it. Maybe they'll think, oh, wait a minute, I am slipping up there. It is the wrong name. I think if something bugs you, you should always say something.
Yes, well, I argued with a lady who is, I think his name is Kerwin, who deals with some kind of Democratic social events around here, and she said, oh, yes, this was very good English, perfectly acceptable and whatnot. And I said, it's Republican propaganda. She looked absolutely uncomprehending.
There are examples, though, in the language of people taking a word and using it to describe themselves in a positive way. Take the word queer, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yes, now it has become almost acceptable. Absolutely.
Well, yeah, you reappropriate the language and use it in your own way. And, there's been a movement on in the States to reappropriate the word gay because a lot of people resent that it's been being used, for a description of people who are homosexual. And it used to have this nice connotation of, something being sweet and happy. And so there's a movement on in the States to bring that word back into the fold, so to speak. But I don't know if they're going to get too far with that. But, you know, it is a common tactic, especially if it's something that's insulting. That if you use it, then, certainly the word nigger is a good example. A lot of black people use that, and they've reappropriated it. So it's not, if you use it yourself, then it's not an insult, and it doesn't sting as much if someone else uses it, although that's not a good example for that. But so, yeah, that's certainly a common thing. You see it all the time.
Mm. Do you think what we're talking about here is word rage?
Well, yes, absolutely. It's word rage, language rage. I think a lot of people... they think the language should be, they grew up with it a certain way, or they just, they're well taught, so they know things are supposed to be a certain way. They've learned their rules, and, a lot of people then think that anything that differs from that is barbaric, and, a lot of times it is, and, they're quite right to protest. You know, we shouldn't go gently into that good night if the change means that the language is less clear and less concise and less useful, but the language, as I say, does change, and I think we have to really appreciate it, because a lot of times those changes are they're good things, and sometimes they may not seem all that good. But the word nice used to mean I think foolish, and 300 years ago, and now it obviously means something completely different. And a lot of people might have protested that at the time when that word was changing meaning, but now, we wouldn't even think of it. It's, we'd be silly to use the word nice to mean foolish. So it's the language does change constantly, and that will never change, because that's the beauty of the English language, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm. We've used up all the time. It went so quickly. Paul, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon. Maybe we can do this again in the future.
I'd love to, Celeste. It was great talking to you and your listeners.
Paul McFredries has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He is the author of Word Spy, The Word Lover's Guide to Modern Culture. The book is published by Broadway Books. You can also find Word Spy on the World Wide Web at www.wordspy.com. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thanks very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade, it was not turnaround Tuesday at the board as futures in the bean pit finished the day lower again today, down 15.5 cents in the nearby contract. The November futures were off just 3.5, though, and that was more typical of what was happening at the Board of Trade in the grain side of the floor, where the corn was down about 1 to 2 cents for the day, and the wheat was up, actually, between a quarter and 2.5 cents. That May futures in the wheat pit actually did finish 2.5 higher at 419, rather 416.5. Their high was at 419. May wheat had a low of 406.5 and a settlement price there at 416.5. Once again, they finished the day 2.5 higher. July futures in the wheat pit, 424 for the high, low at 414, a settlement price at 422.5, up 1.5. And September, 427 the high today, the low at 418.5, settlement price 425.5, up 2.25. December wheat, 435 the high, the low at 425, settlement price there 433, up 0.25. And the March futures in the wheat pit, 436 the high, the low at 429, settled 436, and they finished 1.5 higher. From the corn pit, the May futures settled the day at 326.75. They were down 2.75, had a high of 329.5, the low at 325 for a 4.5 cent trading range for the day. Very short, down 2.75 in that May contract in the corn pit. July futures, 336, the high, the low at 331.5, a settlement price at 333.5, down 2.75. And September's 336, the high, the low at 331.5, a settlement price at 332.5, down 3. December contract in the corn, 335, the high, the low at 331, a settlement price down 3 cents at 332.25. March contract for the corn, 336, the high, the low at 332.5, the March settled 333.5, down 3, and the May 05 corn, 337 high, the low at 334.75, a settlement price at 336.5, down 1.5 for that May contract. July 2005, 336.5, the high, the low at 334.5, a settlement 336.25, down 1.75, and December 2 years out, 282, the high, the low at 280.5, December 05 corn, settlement price down just 0.25 cents to 281.5 for the day. May oats, 175, the high, the low at 170.75, settlement price at 172.5, they finished 1.25 lower, and July oats at 180.25 high, the low at 175.5, a settlement at 177.5, and they finished down 2.25 for the day. From the soy complex, the nearby May soybeans, 1021 the high for the day, the low at 1003, a settlement price 6 cents above that at 1009, down 15.5 cents. July futures, 1018 the high, the low at 998, settled 1006.5, down 16.5 cents. And the August soybeans, 970 the high, the low at 957, settled at 964.5, down 9.5 cents. September futures, 861 the high, the low at 850, settled 854.5, down 10.5. And the November, this year new crop, 780 the high, the low at 768, settled 779, down 3.5 cents. January bean, 782 the high, the low at 774, a settlement price at 779, down 2.5. And the March futures in the bean pit, 771 the high, the low at 765, settled 771. They were down a nickel for the day. May bean meal, 325 the high, the low at 320, a settlement price 321.80, finished 470 lower. The July meal, 322.50 on the high, the low at 317.30, settled 319.50. They were down 5 even. May bean oil, 32.65 the high, the low at 31.86, settlement price at 32.41. Down 33, and July oil, 32.50 for the high. The low there, 31.78, settlement price at 32.26, and they finished down 42 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Thanks, Todd. Prices were higher today on the Mercantile Exchange and feeder cattle, live cattle, and lean hogs. May bellies, though, finished lower. April feeder cattle, 90.75 the high, 89.90 the low, 90.72.5 the settlement, that up 75. May, 87.85 the high, 86.75 the low, 87.72.5 the settlement, that up 90. August, 88.37.5 the high, 87.40 the low, 88.35 the settlement, that up 75. April live cattle, 81.57.5 the high, 80.85 the low, 81.40 the settlement, that up 57.5. June, 76.85 the high, 75.80 the low, 76.80 the settlement, that up 60. August, 75.95 the high, 75.22.5 the low, 75.90 the settlement, that up 37.5. October live cattle, 77.30 the high, 76.80 the low, 77.25 the settlement, that up 22.5. April lean hog, 63.60 the high, 62.80 the low, 63.50 the settlement, that up 10. May, 68.10 the high, 66.40 the low, 68.05 the settlement, that up 125. June, 74.87.5 the high, 72.70 the low, 74.82.5 the settlement, that up 195. July lean hog, 72.55 the high, 70.20 the low, 72.50 the settlement, that up 195. And May pork bellies, today's high 107.15, the low 105.65, the settlement 106.95, that down 15. The Dow Jones Industrial Average now up 2 points at 10,560. The NASDAQ is down 17 at 2062. The S&P 500 down 2 at 1148.
This is Les Schulte, WILL's Director of Corporate Support. If you own or manage an agribusiness, you can help in supporting this valuable service on AM 580. To find out more information, give us a call at 217-333-0850.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Mitch Duche from Waltham, Massachusetts writes, "Dear Dr. Science, what is the real difference between a fruit and a vegetable?"
I'll tell you a secret. There's no difference, other than the packaging. Vegetables are simply dried out fruits, where most of the juice has evaporated through the skin and the sweetness has gone sour. Of course, there are other, less essential, cosmetic differences, like the fact that fruits attract bugs at a far greater rate than vegetables do, the curious lack of consumer interest in vegetable-flavored chewing gum. I understand in certain countries they put sliced radishes on top of their cornflakes, but I've never visited such a place, and I doubt if I ever will.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI Public Radio International. To order the Duck's Breath CD pack, including Dr. Science's new Get Smart disc, the new Best of Duck's Breath collection, and the new Ian Scholes compilation, I Gotta Go, three